Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, there are job interviews, and then there are job interviews. And if you're one of the six finalist candidates for music director and conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic, it's not 30 minutes with a hiring manager. It's not lunch with a prospective boss. It's an entire week in Lexington.
Every day is packed with meetings, tours of the Bluegrass area, meetings with our various boards of directors. Our staff will be meeting with each candidate. We will be having a reception, for example, during the day to invite community leaders, political leaders, and donors to come meet the candidate. After the concert, there will be an open invitation to everybody in the audience to come meet the candidate and ask questions. Then the search committee will have a one-on-one meeting with each candidate, and we'll conclude the whole week of activities where individuals will open up their homes to allow us to use that as a fundraising opportunity for people to come and meet the candidate.
Lexville Executive Director Allison Kaiser has so far hosted candidate Thomas Heuser of Idaho Falls. We're now on the line with candidate number two, Akiko Fujimoto, Associate Conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra. She will be in Lexington in the coming week doing all that Allison Kaiser mentioned, culminating with conducting a program entitled Deep Music. You'll find her full bio on the facts and information page on our website, eswku.com. Greetings, Akiko.
Greetings.
Are you ready for this intense week ahead?
I am. I'm so excited to be on the ground and start rehearsing with the musicians of the Lexington Philharmonic and make great music and share it with the audience.
Tell us how music came into your life and how it became your life's work.
Well, apparently my mother was playing a lot of classical music while I was in her womb. I think that counts for something. But it took until about 5 years after I came out of her womb for me to actually start playing an instrument, and that was the piano. She put me in a group piano lesson because we had just moved to a new city, and she wanted me to meet other kids. I played the trombone after starting on the trumpet, and I always sang in choirs. And then once I got to college, the trombone sort of took a back seat, but I started to do more singing and actually start conducting.
If you were pressed to describe your musical personality, what would you say?
I think my conducting personality has a lot of intensity, integrity, and passion. I'm a very, very passionate person who feels a lot, but maybe because of my Japanese background. You know, I might not express it when we're just talking to each other in the way that you would describe as passionate, but once I'm on the podium, conducting is my instrument. It's my medium of expression. It's the instrument that I feel most comfortable expressing myself musically. And somehow all of the passion inside of me gets unleashed. And it's the greatest feeling I have when I'm making music and sharing that passion with the musicians on stage and then with the audience.
When you're in Lexington, you're going to be conducting a program entitled, as I mentioned in the introduction, Deep Music. What is most exciting to you about the program that you'll be conducting?
Well, it's the fact that they chose the program for us, but it's the perfect program for me. That was a great coincidence. The first piece, Deep Summer Music, is by a Minnesotan composer, Libby Larson. And I had already met her when that piece was assigned to me by the Lexington Philharmonic, and I had already performed a couple of her pieces. I immediately was like, wow, how lucky am I that I already met the composer. I haven't done this piece in particular, but I feel very, you know, familiar with her and her style. And I had read her biography in addition to meeting her in person because I was studying other music by her. So I feel very lucky about that. And then the Ginastera, the harp concerto, I feel very lucky about because I had spent 5 years before coming to Minnesota in San Antonio, Texas, where the population is 65% Latino. And so part of my job was to do Latin-influenced or Latin American music a lot. It was our way of connecting with the community. And it was a genre that I had not really explored before, because all of us who go to music schools and conservatories, our core repertoire, the meat and potatoes, tend to be the Central European and maybe, you know, Russian. You know, those two are sort of the bread and butter of what we do when we're growing up as musicians. So I hadn't really done a lot of Latin, and then I had to do it, and I feel very comfortable, even though the harp concerto itself is not overtly folk influenced. I feel a lot of affinity for music of the Americas, especially Southern and Central Americas. And the Beethoven, I mean, how much luckier can a girl get? And Beethoven 7 is one of the greatest miracles of Western civilization. And first of all, Beethoven, his symphonies are a conductor's Bible. That's what we start studying, and that's what we die studying. They're our life's work. And number 7 in particular is a piece that we all love performing. It's exciting. It's rhythmic. It gets quite intense and crazy toward the end. But then, of course, there's a slower second movement that is very famous and has been used in movie soundtracks and very iconic music. So popular that, you know, when Beethoven premiered it, he had to encore that second movement. So, you know, I just feel very lucky that I was given this wonderful program.
I mentioned that you'll be conducting the Lexington Philharmonic on the 25th, but on the evening before that, you will also lead Lexville's annual Music Builds Discovery concert, which is a field trip for Central Kentucky students. Do you enjoy taking the music to young listeners?
Yes, absolutely. I have been doing young people's concerts for the past 10 years of my life with various organizations, and I have a ton of experience with education concerts, both programming and presenting. And every orchestra does it a little bit differently. The one thing that's new about this Discovery concert is it is meant to target the widest range of age groups that I've ever encountered. Apparently, there will be anybody from third graders to high school students. I'm used to breaking things up a little bit more by age group, but this is a new challenge for me, and I'm up for it.
Well, thinking about the audience in more broad terms, what's your philosophy about community engagement?
Well, first of all, the role of the orchestra in any community is extremely important. I think it should be the center of the fine arts community, performing arts community. It tends to be the largest organization, arts organization in any community, just because of the sheer force and the resources that it takes to mount a professional orchestra concert. But I think it needs to be the central figure that is a resource for everybody, that plays the most important, and I don't want to put a value on different genres of music and type performances. Everything, everybody is important. But an orchestra has the ability to be the incubator for, you know, at the highest level, and also be the connector of all the different arts groups in the community, whether it be dance groups, ballet, or opera, or children's chorus, school music ensembles, youth orchestras, you know, and college ensembles. But an orchestra needs to be the central clearinghouse for all things artistic. And I'm sure many of the musicians in the Philharmonic teach in the area, and their presence is enormously important, that these talented folks are actually living in the area. I know many people commute from elsewhere into Lexington for these concerts, but the ones that do live there, you know, they serve the community on a weekly basis by teaching lessons and being part of the community and just living and breathing there. So I think having a professional orchestra like that in a community, it just enriches everything. We should also reach out and go into the community playing different venues, and not just play, but also talk to the audience, mingle with the audience before and after performances. Because without the audience and the community's support and understanding, we don't exist. So we need to constantly show our appreciation and, most importantly, relevance. The Philharmonic needs to be indispensable to people's lives in a way that they can't imagine living in Lexington without the orchestra being there.
Well, you mentioned living here, living in Lexington, and obviously you are open to the prospect because you're a finalist conductor. But can you tell me a little bit more about that, about what excites you
of
about
course.
The possibility of living in Lexington, Kentucky?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not too familiar with that part of the country yet. I've lived in California and in Northeast and then the South for the past 10 years. And now I'm in upper Midwest, but very, very cold. So I will be looking forward to...
We get all four seasons to the hilt here. Let me just warn you.
That's exactly what I was going to say, that I'm going to enjoy the four different temperaments, but hopefully you don't have the minus 28 degree weather in January or February. Okay, good. I was hoping that was not the case. And I'm looking forward to beautiful seasons. I know there's a lot of great nature. Obviously, you're the horse capital and the bourbon capital mm-hmm. of the United States. So these are sort of like the fun things, you know, obvious things about Lexington. But the reason I would be excited to live in Lexington is because I would like to be part of community. As I mentioned before, you know, the people in the Philharmonic that live there and teach and go grocery shopping there, you know, I actually just started a music directorship of an orchestra in Texas that is just 5 weeks a year, but it's a non-residential job. It's called the Mid-Texas Symphony. And I commute there from wherever I am. And they do not require residence. It's a, you know, smaller scope of an organization, much smaller than Lexington Philharmonic. And as much as I enjoy that, I really am looking forward to having my first residential music directorship. And I'm hoping that's the Lexington Philharmonic, because to be a music director, I think, really means that to have the greatest impact on the organization, you need to be part of the community. And it's fun to be a flyby conductor, too. But I think at the scope of the Lexington Philharmonic, you do need to keep a residence there and be available for meetings and events and not cram everything into the concert weeks, and just let your life there breathe so that the organization and I can do the planning and brainstorming and all that, you know, and not stress about doing everything the week of the visit or something like that. So I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about making music with this great orchestra. I know some of the, your former music director, Scott Terrell, used to be in my position years ago at the Minnesota Orchestra. And some of the musicians and staff are still friends with him. They keep in touch. And, you know, they know about the Lexington Philharmonic, and they're all excited about it for me. And as amazing as the Minnesota Orchestra is, of course, being a staff conductor is a different story than being a music director. And that's something I'm really, you know, looking forward to developing into, is having kind of a curatorial position, not just being a conductor of a certain specific concert, mm-hmm. but being able to curate the overall experience, and kind of like a chef, you know, designing a meal. If you could compare a season, an orchestra season, to a meal, I would love to design a great season, you know, with everybody in the organization, but be the driver of the process and give everybody a great experience.
Well, Akiko, you're going to have a very intense and very busy week here ahead, but of course, it's also an opportunity to discover those things that you're looking for, and I think you'll find them.
I think I will. I'm supposed to take a tour of the area on my first day, so I'm excited about that.
Akiko Fujimoto, Associate Conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra and a candidate for Music Director and Conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic. Thanks so much, Akiko.
Thank you.
Coming in November, Kelly Corcoran of Nashville.
Yes, I'm ready. I'm excited.
We'll be talking with Kelly Corcoran on the November 14th edition of Eastern Standard. Coming up after the break,
we estimate that about 40% of the households in eastern Kentucky are inadequately housed.
Scott McReynolds with the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard is enlisting people in drug rehab to learn the skills to build quality, energy-efficient, affordable homes. And Mae Humiston with the nonprofit Redbud Financial Alternatives is helping people buy those homes.
Our mission is really to transform credit from an obstacle to an opportunity.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
From WMMT in Whitesburg, we're joined by Scott McReynolds. He's Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance, a nonprofit affordable housing provider based in Hazard. They have a goal of housing 1,000 Appalachian Kentucky families within the next decade. This summer, Scott's organization was awarded major funding in support of that mission, and the money is for some key projects that combine addiction recovery, job training, and affordable housing. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And first, briefly, if you would, tell our listeners about the core mission of the Housing Development Alliance.
The mission of the Housing Development Alliance is to use the power of housing to transform lives and build a brighter future for our community. And we talk about the power of housing, we like to think about it as kind of like a bowl. You know, it's possible to make a cake without a bowl, but it's really hard and it's messy and it takes a long time and the results may not be quite as good. So housing provides that kind of bowl to make the cake. And so we know people can succeed without a quality home, but it's a lot easier to have a good life and to succeed if you have, that quality home, that base. We know students do better in school. Parents do better as employees when they have a quality house. So we're trying to provide that base. And then the piece about the brighter future for the community is really around the notion that quality housing is good, not just for the folks who live in it, but also for the whole community. When you build houses, you put people to work, you increase the tax base, and there's just lots of positive benefits to affordable housing.
Well, Scott, I've heard that quality, affordable housing in Appalachia is in crisis, and that's a word that's often used, sometimes overused. But would you agree with that assessment?
I think I would. We estimate that about 40% of the households in eastern Kentucky are inadequately housed, and that includes folks who are living in substandard housing, people who are cost burdened, that is, they're paying more than 30% of their income toward housing, or people that are overcrowded.
Are there other factors that are unique to the region that affect the need for new housing and for home repair?
You know, we've got several challenges. I mean, we are a persistent poverty area. We've had higher than national average poverty rates for 40 or 50 years. When a region is poor for so long, that really presents some challenges, and housing stock is one of those things that just degrades over time. Of course, we have a lot of steep hillsides and flood-prone valleys, so that makes it kind of hard to find land. So that can increase the challenge to providing affordable housing. And then I think just possibly because of the poverty and possibly for some other reasons, we have a real high percentage. About 35% of our housing stock is manufactured housing. And at least a long time ago, manufactured housing really wasn't built to last. And so we have a lot of aging mobile homes that kind of increase our challenges.
Yeah, I think I've read that there's an inordinate number of pre-70s trailers in the area.
Yeah, there's a significant number.
So tell us about this funding that the HDA received this summer.
So we received a power grant for our Hope Building Program. And the Hope Building Program kind of grew out of, we do a couple of community work days where members of the community come out and volunteer with us. And some of the volunteers that always showed up were from the Perry County Drug Court and then later on from Hickory Hill Recovery Center. And I really noticed two things. First, I noticed that our carpenters always bragged on those volunteers and would say, you know, that guy really knew what he was doing or she was a great worker. And a lot of times the carpenters don't always brag on volunteers. So that was kind of out of the ordinary. And then the recovery providers would always talk about how that the work the folks in recovery were doing with us was the most meaningful work that they got to do. So when you're in recovery, there's a real, my understanding is at some point at a stage in recovery where you really want to give back to your community, sort of making amends maybe for the trouble that your addiction caused. And so this is an opportunity for people really to give back. And there's something almost spiritual about building too, where, you know, you start and there's nothing there. And then at the end of the day, you can see what you've done. And so it was a really meaningful experience for the folks in recovery. And so we started talking, and I'll be honest, when we started talking, I thought, well, maybe we can come up with enough money to do like one house. But in talking with Judge Wells of the Perry County Drug Court, I soon realized that what people really needed to succeed in recovery was that first opportunity to go to work, that somebody to take a chance on them and provide them with that initial job. And so out of that, we kind of decided to create a paid on-the-job training program. So Hope Building provides people in recovery with a paid work opportunity. They get training in energy-efficient construction. Our partner, the Hazard Community and Technical College, is providing a day of classroom, so they'll be earning some college credit and some certificates. And then East Kentucky Concentrated Employment is also providing a lot of job training. So we're kind of combining all of that to provide that initial employment opportunity.
This funding came your way this past summer. I think you announced it in July, if I'm correct about that, and made this happen, made it move forward. From what sources? Where does the money come from?
So the big grant we got that's kind of holding everything together is an Appalachian Regional Commission power grant. And that's some of the money that was created to help coal-impacted communities build a new economy. So we were delighted to get that. And then, like I've already mentioned, the partners, and they're a key role. They're all providing not necessarily direct funding, but lots of critical services. And then from that, we'll be building some additional funding. We got a program-related investment from the Appalachian Impact Fund, which is really exciting. It's the first one they've done. And that's some money that we'll use to help construct the houses. So one of the unique things about this, you know, typically job training programs, you have to keep investing grant money because you always have to pay job trainees. So we wanted to make this a sustaining program. So these folks are actually going to be building moderate income or workforce housing that we will then sell. And hopefully by the end of the grant period, we've gotten to the point that we're building enough houses and able to sell them at a price that pays for the training so that this program can continue past that first grant.
Do these funding sources, do they give you the flexibility that you need to effectively address the factors that we talked about earlier?
Generally, I think so. I mean, it was a little interesting reading the ARC grant guidelines and hearing what they wanted to achieve and saying, that's what we're doing. And then, you know, when you get down to some of the nitty gritty details, there's a little bit of the round hole and the square peg or square peg in the round hole kind of thing. But, you know, we were able to, that's some of the creativity you have to use. And then you combine that with local money, like the Appalachian Impact Fund investment, that's a lot more flexible to kind of fill in the gaps where the funding doesn't allow flexibility.
So tell us about the training that's being provided to people who want to step up and take part in this.
So it's great. Like I said, we're training them by they're literally building the house. And our trainer's philosophy, he tells them every day, I'm not going to build this house. You're going to build this house. I'm going to teach you how to do it. And so they're doing the bulk of the work, learning lots of different skills, everything from, you know, reading a tape line to, you know, how to trim a house, which is a lot more complicated. One of the big focus is energy efficient construction, because that's something that we care about, and then quality construction.
I was going to ask you about energy efficiency, because Appalachia has always had cheap energy due to low coal prices, and all that's changing. And so there's more incentive than ever to cut utility bills. Can you go into a little bit more detail about how these homes are being made energy efficient?
Sure. We are 100% Energy Star Builder, which is a program that uses a third party to actually verify the energy uses of the house. And so some of the key things we do, we really focus on things that you only get one shot at, like putting insulation in the walls, because once the house is built, it's really hard to go back and do that. We do a lot of caulking, believe it or not. You know, making the house airtight is essential. We actually build the houses so tight that we then have to add a mechanical ventilation system to make sure that the air turns over. But by doing that, you make sure that the house is as tight as possible. Of course, we use energy efficient appliances and energy efficient heating and cooling. We seal up the ductwork. There's some staggering statistic that like 30% of the air that we condition in America gets lost through leaky ducts. And so, you know, we make our ductwork as airtight as possible. And when you combine all those little things, in the end, we land up with a house that uses about 60% of the electricity that you would expect a house of that size to use.
Do you foresee the demand for housing, affordable housing, in particular in the region, sustainable, strong enough to sustain a career in home building over the long term?
I do. Like I said, you know, we have such a large percentage of the population that's inadequately housed. And currently in our market, we kind of have a broken housing market currently where the cost to build a modest home actually exceeds its appraised value. And that's a real challenge. And it's one of the reasons why, as you drive around our service area, you don't see a lot of $150,000, $160,000 houses being built. And of course, that's the kind of the price range that most working families can afford. And so we're actually hoping to, through this project, to be able to help the appraisals out and get to the point where the market is no longer broken. And that will really open up the market to lots of builders and not just us. And that'll create more jobs and more opportunities for people to earn a living.
Scott McReynolds, he's executive director of the Housing Development Alliance based in Hazard, Kentucky. And he joins us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott McReynolds mentioned that a high proportion of households in eastern Kentucky are cost burdened, paying more than 30% of their income toward housing. Scott is also executive director of Redbud Financial Alternatives, which was created to help people in the region overcome these financial hurdles. Mae Humiston is Community Development Financial Institution Director at Redbud, and she's next up at the mic at WMMT in Whitesburg. Thanks for joining us, Mae.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Mae, first, if you would, tell us about the mission of Redbud Financial Alternatives.
So our mission is really to transform credit from an obstacle to an opportunity. That really means that credit can be the reason that you're paying kind of debilitating amounts in fees and interest, or it can be a tool to build an asset, like in the case of a mortgage. So our goal is really to help more people get to the point where they can leverage credit towards a bigger long-term goal or a dream.
What kind of burdens are you encountering? I can think, for example, of payday loans. Do you see a lot of that?
Sure. We see a fair number of payday loans, but we see a lot of high-cost, high-rate credit cards and personal loans. Mm-hmm. And that oftentimes people are kind of mixing and matching these different forms of credit to try to make ends meet. And a lot of times they originally got into those situations because of kind of a one-time emergency, but then haven't really been able to get back out of that just due to, you know, some of those interest rates that start to snowball on people.
What area or which counties do you serve?
We primarily serve Breathitt, not Leslie and Perry County in eastern Kentucky, but we can also, to a certain level, serve any county that touches those four counties.
We talked about payday loans and about super high interest rates on credit cards. What other conditions are you addressing?
We were originally founded by the Housing Development Alliance because, as you heard from Scott, kind of the work they do help connect people to housing solutions. And they were finding that something like 90% of the people coming through their door weren't eligible based on credit and debt issues. So even if someone is not currently cost burdened, they might have been in the past and that might have totally wrecked their credit score, or they might have some sort of collections on their credit report that's just bringing their credit score down. And having those things impact your credit history and your credit score and then not really knowing how to deal with that, that can have so many costs throughout your life. You know, you're going to pay more for your car payments. You're going to pay more in interest on your home. You're going to pay more in deposits on apartments or for utilities. And so we see a lot of people trying to figure out how to recover from negative history on their credit report, but with very little information to do so.
And speaking of conditions, I'm not sure that everybody in our listening audience realizes the pretty significant difference in average median household income in Redbud's target market compared with the state or the nation.
Yeah. So I think the nation, this is what I got from the U.S. Census Quick Facts most recently, but the U.S. median household income is about $57,000, $58,000. The Kentucky median household income is about $10,000 less than that, about $46,000. Perry County, which is where Redbud is headquartered, is only $32,000. And then Leslie County, which is one of our target market counties, is $28,000. So that's half of the U.S. median household income.
Wow. Now, you're well into year two of a three-year strategic plan, and it lists five priorities. What are they?
Sure. So our five priorities have been, one, to essentially rescue consumers from those predatory and high-cost lending practices, and to do so through fair and equitable loan products. Number two, to help empower our clients to make informed decisions using accessible, relevant, and quality financial education and counseling. And then to use those together to help build personal assets. You know, that's enabling affordable quality home ownership and then the maintenance of that home through repairs, as well as continuing the asset development of our area's workforce by making sure that the credit needs of our workforce are met. People can get their kids to childcare. People can get their car fixed so that they can continue to get to work. And then finally, just to have an organization that can continue to serve people for many years to come.
The summary of that strategic plan also says that negative externally imposed narratives have been internalized by the community. And of course, we are intimately familiar with that. But if you could elaborate a little bit.
You know, when you've been told over and over again that you're poor, you'll always be poor, you're not worth investments, you're uninvestable. And then to be constantly told that from a level that you can't defend yourself against, it's really hard to maintain hope or the self-confidence, that assurance that you are indeed investable, you are indeed worth something. And so that's something that we try to counter, is to say, you are investable, do dream at the investable level, because when you don't dream at that investable level, it's very limiting. It can limit your dreams and your hopes and your belief in what you are able to become.
I guess after a while, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and perpetuates that self-awareness in the area. And it sounds to me as though what Redbud is setting out to do is to break the cycle, to give people an opportunity to see themselves differently.
Yeah, exactly. To say our people are worth an investment. We are worth multiple chances. To say just because this instance happened, it doesn't mean that you should be punished for a decision for the rest of your life. Specifically for us, that's related to credit. You know, so if you had a medical emergency, you know, having a medical collections on your credit report continues to hurt. But that life instance shouldn't be something you're punished for over and over and over again just because of your life circumstances. And so figuring out this tool to help empower people to say, you're right, I don't need to live with that for so long. I have the tools, I have the knowledge, I have the resources to move towards something that's better, and I deserve to have those.
I also see in the plan summary that there's this feeling of being on the cusp, on the verge of economic and social change, but that many people are still dispirited because coordinated changes are not coming quickly enough, and many of the interventions feel too acute for what are ultimately chronic systemic issues. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Communities in the mountains are not new to poverty. This area has been underinvested and extracted from for decades, and it's going to take just as long to reverse the impacts of that, right? But people need to be able to see progress in order to maintain that long-term hope that it's going to take to continue to do the hard work. And so, you know, the reason we brought that up in our strategic plan is as a reminder to us as a community-based organization is, one, to celebrate the wins so that we can say, look, here's a success. Two, to not get discouraged when the work is hard, because it's going to often be hard. And then three, that it is worth it. It is totally worth it to take the time to collaborate, to coordinate with the other people doing good work. And that one is pretty essential to all of our work. We are piloting a new product with the community college. We're working with the Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program. We're working with Housing Development Alliance. We're working with so many different partners because we see the good work and we know that together we're going to do it more strongly, stronger.
What kind of service has Redbud performed that has sent you home after a day's work feeling that you actually made a difference?
I think most recently that would be that we created a product in response to the Black Jewel mine closures and bankruptcy. I'm sure people are familiar with that, but that mm-hmm. miners woke up one day, were told that the mines were closed and found that their most recent paychecks have been clawed back and that their next ones never came, their next paychecks never came. And so the Redbud board, which is a community-based board, said, we need to respond to this. This is what our purpose is. And we were able to create a product that is up to $4,000, which was the average paycheck that we saw that had been clawed back. And we were able to help 25 miners with a low interest rate loan in the first 3 months of payments. There were no payments for the first 3 months, and there's no interest accruing in those first 3 months either. The idea being that if something great happens and they got their payback, that they could then pay off the loan. But then after those 3 months, to help them start rebuilding their credit after having this period kind of where all of their payments are just they've been interrupted and their credit history is really going to suffer for that. So helping them see that long vision to not having this something that was so out of their control have even longer term impact on their lives.
Well, that's a really great immediate example of the work that you're doing there. We appreciate your time. Mae Hoveston is Community Development Financial Institution Director at Redbud Financial Alternatives in Hazard, and she joins us from WMMT in Whitesburg. Thanks a lot, Mae.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up in a moment, eco and adventure tourism as part of an economic plan B for Eastern Kentucky.
I think that's what we need in our state is that Office of Outdoor Creation that drives the conversation, provides resources, and keeps track of that data.
And the psychology of losing your way out there.
One of the things that many survivors recount as their greatest fear is not being hurt or dying, but rather being embarrassed.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We have Jerry James in the studio. Jerry is the founder of Explore Kentucky. He's state director of the American Canoe Association, and he has a finger on the pulse of recreational, eco, and adventure tourism and recreation and the outdoors in general in Kentucky. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you for having me here.
So tell us about Explore Kentucky. How did this get started?
So it started when I was in college, my senior year. I had been helping out in Campbellsville, Kentucky with a lot of tourism-oriented things. And I've always been an outdoor adventurer, you know, conservationist all my life. And so I saw an opportunity after I had interned with the 2012 Super Bowl as part of their social media team. I was like, you know what? I can use social media, earned media, and just creative campaigns to kind of create a campaign to kind of tell Kentucky's story beyond bourbon, bluegrass, and basketball. Because Kentucky, it's an underrated state when it comes to outdoor recreation. We have it all. We have mountains. We have streams. We have lakes. We have trails. And so I was like, you know what? This thing called Instagram had just popped off.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, wait, we can use our smartphones and Instagram and photos to tell these stories. And so I started an Instagram account, and it all came from there.
Did I hear you say you interned with the 2012 Super Bowl?
Yeah. So I was part of the host committee in Indianapolis for the Super Bowl. So they had this big, giant social media command center. And it was just like, you know, rows of like – they had 25 iMacs in there, really robust social media software. And we were aggregating all the content that people were talking about in the Super Bowl. And we're trying to drive conversations. So if someone cited Madonna on the other side of Indianapolis, we're like – we amplified that and posted it. Or if people need directions, like, you know, oh, I'm looking for the hotel, or I'm looking for something in the NFL village, we tweeted out from the official accounts to let people – give people that information. And so it was really cool to be behind the scenes of that. It was a massive operation.
And so now you're able to draw on all that experience and know-how to make this work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also saw that you're a Project Learning Tree educator. What is that? What do you do?
Project Learning Tree, I got my certification, I think, back in 2016. And it's just – there's like Project WET, which is focused on water education. There's forest education. So I got it because I wanted to be able to articulate biodiversity and southern forests to kids, to the general public. And so I felt that was a really good tool to have in my tool bag.
There's a lot of talk these days about tourism as one way to revitalize eastern Kentucky communities. And I'd like to talk about that for a minute and break it down into a couple of parts. And first, what has to change in your mind to make that a realistic prospect?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack from that question. What has to change? I think we need more creativity and we need more people involved. So there's a few... I call them like OGs, original gangsters. There's a few OG people in the region involved with it, but they're not. It's not a whole team-driven, community-driven process.
Do you sense that there's a lack of cohesion? And if that cohesion were there, and I guess I'm thinking about some sort of overarching organization that could serve to attract investment.
Boom. You hit on it. So out west, and it's starting to trickle out all around the country, state governments are creating these things called offices of outdoor recreation.
Huh.
So I believe Utah was one of the first states to get one. And these offices of outdoor recreation, they're essentially under whatever state's economic development cabinet. And they're basically seeing outdoor recreation as a economic driver, you know, towards a state's like GDP. So they're kind of flipping what people think of outdoor recreation. We think about outdoor recreation, people tend to think about, oh, it's fun, hanging out with the family, but they don't see it of like the money that you can make for communities. And so I think that's what we need in our state is that Office of Outdoor Recreation that drives the conversation, provides resources, and keeps track of that data, you know?
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, on the flip side of what might be lacking at the moment, there are a lot of assets out there, a lot of natural assets to, and I hate to use this word, but to exploit if we do it in a sustainable, proper way.
Yeah, exploit. I don't know. I get what you're saying. Yeah, utilize. There is a way to marry outdoor recreation with conservation, and that's a big testimony to my work. So I consider myself – I didn't actually know that I was an entrepreneur maybe until about last year. People are like, oh, you're an entrepreneur, and I didn't know that. But what I understand just coming from a conservation and environmental science standpoint, a lot of community leaders – big businesses, people don't really care about saving the earth. You know, it's America. People care about the almighty dollar. So if I can bring an event, do an event that brings, you know, 400 people to the Kentucky River, then I can do an economic impact report and say, oh, this event brought $25,000 just from this one day. Then I have something to go to these leaders and say like, hey, this is why we should keep the river clean. Because it is doing this for the local economy. And so that's kind of like my way of doing conservation.
Well, I think of an entrepreneur as somebody who's identified a need and has figured out how to respond to that need. Does that feel comfortable to you?
That's exactly what I've been trying to do. I've been trying to show through all the things that I do, from our paddle sports races to guided hikes to doing excursions, branding, merch for the outdoors. I've been trying to show people like this is the potential we have.
When we're talking about adventure tourism, ecotourism, outdoor recreation, we're setting up the likelihood that there's going to be a lot of tension between conservationists and recreationalists.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that we should anticipate as ecotourism, adventure tourism grows in this state?
Yes. That is one of the biggest topics right now in both communities is, you know, especially with social media. You know, back in the past, like, you know, say that you wanted to find that, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the River Gorge, and you wanted to find this really beautiful waterfall in the Clifty Wilderness area. Well, guess what? You had to have someone that had that intimate knowledge or find like a dusty guidebook to get there. Now I can just boot up my phone, download All Trails app, and boom, I can go to that waterfall. So now because of social media, it's made it easier. And now there's a lot of mass visitation, which is providing like a degradation to these areas. So there is that tension of, you know, yes, we want people to get outside and have fun and see new areas, but at the same time, how do we not degrade these areas that are sensitive or have sensitive ecosystems? So it's a big combo in the community.
And as one who is out there, you're out there on a regular basis in the forests and the streams of the Commonwealth. Are you seeing indications not only of that, of people not respecting the environment, but also on a larger scale, climate change or challenges to habitat?
Yeah, I do see a lot of degradation to the environment. You know, the River Gorge is like, I mean, it's a hot topic right now because mm-hmm. it's one of the most amazing natural areas in the country. And it's also not far from three major metropolitan areas, Lexington, Louisville, and Cincinnati. So it gets a lot of usage. So I'm seeing like trees chopped down, trash, illegal campsites, all kinds of things. And on the climate change deal, I mean, we've been seeing it over the past couple of years, especially with our wildfires. You know, that's because of climate change. And so it's been a phenomenon that's been happening in Kentucky over the past few years, especially in East Kentucky.
Jerry James is founder of Explore Kentucky. He's state director of the American Canoe Association and also a board member of the Kentucky Conservation Committee. Thanks for coming in, Jerry.
Thank you. And I want to say this. Follow us on Instagram. You know, on Instagram, Explore Kentucky has, I think, nearly 50,000 followers on Instagram. And we've had our hashtag Explore Kentucky used over 200,000 times. So that's one of the biggest tools we use to kind of spread the story of Kentucky's outdoors. So follow us on Instagram.
Okay, everybody, go to Instagram, find Jerry. Thanks a lot.
Cool.
Archaeologist and wilderness survival expert Chris Begley is back, and the focus is on the psychology of survival in the wild. Greetings, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
Chris, you want to talk about the psychological aspects of finding yourself stranded or lost out there in the wild. But first, let's touch on some of the physical things that can happen and that can lead to psychological issues.
One of the most immediate would just be finding yourself in an uncomfortable and unfamiliar situation. This is enough to create some anxiety and start some of these psychological processes that you might need to deal with. Other things are more direct. Hunger, for instance. We're all familiar with people getting irritable as they get hungry. Well, that can really be exacerbated by having, you know, multiple days of nothing to eat and being in this stressful situation.
So many of these things are kind of intertwined with psychology. Let's turn to that. What are some typical issues that come up when we find ourselves forced by the circumstances into survival mode? First of all, can it take some time to actually realize that we're now in survival mode, that we're on our own?
Yeah, it certainly can, and that's one of the first issues. Many of the acronyms that you'll hear, shorthand ways of remembering what to do in an emergency, will start with something equivalent of stop or sit down. Think about where you are. In other words, analyze your situation and try to keep the panic down, try to keep from reacting in ways that are not going to improve your situation. And one of the most obvious might be the temptation to keep trying to find your way out when you're already lost.
So once we've recognized this, that survival is up to us, nobody's coming to the rescue, what can we do to our minds or with our minds to help us survive this and get out of it intact?
Well, I think a couple of things are worth realizing. One is that our survival instinct, which many of us imagine would kick in these situations, may need to be jump-started. It's not necessarily the case that you're going to do whatever it takes to survive.
It's not as familiar to us these days as it might have been 100 years ago.
It might have been. I suspect even then there were cases where you have to fortify your resolve to make it through some of these tough situations. And that might involve thinking about things that you want to live for, your family, your friends, and keeping that in mind to really make sure you can tough through it.
Have you ever found yourself in these circumstances, and can you tell us about it?
Oh, yeah. As an archaeologist working in some remote areas, there have been situations that suddenly got really dangerous or changed in ways where, you know, everything was now unexpected. And in that case, for me, it always helped that I had a lot of the tools that would enable me to get as much information as I could. I knew where I was. I knew how to tell directions. I knew how to do things like create shelter, start fires, and felt that I was going to be all right in those senses. One of the things that many survivors recount as their greatest fear is not being hurt or dying, but rather being embarrassed. And it's that fear that the situation you're in is going to make you look ridiculous when you get back. You're lost somewhere. You decide you don't know where you are. What if right around the corner, right over the ridge, there's a house and you know you should stop, but you're just afraid that you're 100 yards short of finding that solution. That fear of ridicule, of embarrassment, can be very powerful and very dangerous.
Ask for directions, right?
Exactly.
Archaeologist, wilderness survival expert Chris Begley. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
I lean my back against you, thinking you were an oak. I knew the wind could bend you, but I can't believe you broke.
Now the wind could never break me, only your false love.
Honey, I've been through, I swear by God above.
I thought you were a willow, but you never wept for me. You went home and...
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.